To turn back to Matthew chapter 20, the place of our reading earlier this morning. We'll be talking about that passage in just a moment. I'm sure most of us at some point or other has watched a professional tennis tournament on television. As the players are going at it, you know, occasionally they'll swat a ball wide of the line. It goes bouncing off, and one of the ball boys or ball girls goes and scurries over and gets the ball and immediately goes back to their place, and they crouch down waiting for play to resume. Player gets a little sweaty, he might go, and they run out there and they have the towel, and here's your towel, and he's wiping his brow. In all the great tennis matches that you may have watched in the past, do you remember the name of any of the ball boys? I didn't think so. In fact, if much of any attention comes to them at all, they probably haven't done their job very well. Because as they seek to serve the players who are playing, their job is to facilitate the match by gathering the balls in or tossing another ball to the fellow who's serving or deliver the towel. And if they end up dropping a ball, sometimes they will. They'll drop it and kick it, and you know, everybody kind of gets a chuckle out of that. And they brought attention to themselves, and that's really not what they're there for. They're there to serve. They're there to help facilitate the match that is going on. And so we don't generally associate greatness with being a ball boy in tennis or a ball girl. We don't watch a tennis match like that and aspire to be a ball boy. We want to be one of the players. That's who's remembered. That's who gets the paycheck at the end of the match. That's who gets the trophy. It's the players. And that's who we focus our attention on, is the stars that are on center stage. Well, I'll tell you, serving as a Christian is kind of like being one of those ball boys or ball girls. It is done perhaps in relative anonymity. We're there to kind of blend into the background and contribute to the well-being of others, to see that who and what we are as a family of God's people, that it runs smoothly, that it's facilitated by seeing to the needs of each other. And yet we look at a passage like Matthew 20, and it's interesting that in the course of trying to teach us something about serving, as opposed to the carnal model of leading, Jesus uses the term greatness relative to serving. And so that leads me to wonder, and we're going to explore in the sermon this morning, how is it that there is greatness in serving? Serving the Lord, serving our fellow brethren. How is there greatness in that when Jesus, in fact, is warning us to avoid any sense of pride or arrogance or self-directed credit? In what sense is there greatness in serving? Well, in the carnal model, which Jesus is contrasting here in Matthew chapter 20, there is no greatness in serving. Greatness is in being served. Greatness is holding the reins of power. We're not going to reread this story, but I want to point out a few things to you that Jesus notices and also that's pointed out by Matthew in his narrative of this. What comes from the general human desire to want to be served? Because that's essentially what James and John are appealing to the Lord for, is to be in a position where they're going to be served, not where they will be the servants. Well, I'll tell you one thing it leads to is it leads to scheming. Because it's apparent that James and John and their mother have had some discussion about this. And the scheme involves, apparently, the mother of these two making the appeal to the Lord. Whatever advantage she might or they might have thought would be gained, that's the method of approach that's come out of the scheming. Says the mother came with her sons and made this request. Something else that often comes with the desire to be served is unrealistic expectations. Jesus asks them, are you able? Are you able, in essence, to do what I'm going to do? Are you able to suffer what I'm going to suffer? And their answer just flippantly seems to be, why, sure. We can deal with it. Well, sure, I could be an elder. That's easy. Well, yeah, I'd like to be a preacher. That's obviously easy the way he does it. We look at some other situation that we perceive to be elevated in some way, and we begin to think without deeply contemplating what's going on, I could do that. And we're usually thinking about the glories and the joys and the attention and all these other carnal elements that come from, we think, being in that position. And we don't really think about the stresses and the strains and the pressures and the demands. And so we don't think deeply and carefully, and we look at this position of being served and we say, oh yeah, I can do that. Jesus says, oh really? You could suffer what I'm going to suffer? Be baptized with the baptism I'm going to be baptized with? Something else this kind of carnal ambition results in is encroaching on God's territory. They're asking for something that Jesus says is not even my prerogative to give. It is not mine to give. It is prepared by my Father in heaven. And so this self-exaltation, self-glorification, desire to be served will even take us into territory that belongs to God and will encroach on His prerogatives and His rights. And then finally, we see in this story in verse 24, when the ten heard it, when their colleagues saw the scheming, saw the angle, saw what they were up to, they were moved with indignation against the two brothers. And the seeds for division, the seeds of hard feelings and resentment are being sown by those who want to be served. And Jesus says, what you're doing is what the Gentiles do. He says the Gentiles lord it over them. That is, the Gentiles, they seek to be the tennis player, not the ball boy. They want to be served. They want to be in a position where they have control. They have power. They have what is deemed to be, by carnal standards, success. Gentiles want to be in control. They want to determine policy. They want to enforce the rules. They want to take personal advantage of a leadership position. And Jesus says in verse 26, it shall not be so among you. Jesus will later say before Pontius Pilate at his trial, my kingdom is not of this world. My kingdom does not operate by the principles of worldly kingdoms. Leadership in my spiritual kingdom is not like the leadership of the Gentiles, who are in fierce competition with one another to rule and to have power. And so we find that when Jesus speaks, he so often speaks in opposites. He says things like, in order to live, you have to die. In order to be first, you have to be last. If you're going to take up the sword, you're going to die by the sword. There's all kinds of ways in which Jesus expresses himself by speaking in opposites. And I would suggest to you he does that here. He says in verse 25 about the Gentiles lording it over each other, he says, those who are great exercise authority by the world's model. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And so the question is, how do you become great? By serving. What greatness is there in serving? When Jesus warns us so often not to desire to be great. But yet he says here, if you want to be great, it's going to be by service. What does he mean by that? Actually, I'm going to come back to that later. But in the meantime, I want to say some other things. First of all, what I want us to notice about serving one another, or serving in any capacity spiritually, involves obeying from the heart. That is, as we consider service that the Lord is asking from us, first of all, this isn't an extra. It's not something apart from the essential nature of what it means to be a Christian. Oh, I got being a Christian over here, and there are certain things that are very important to being a Christian. And then on top of that, God asks me to serve. No, that's not the way this works. Serving one another becomes fundamental to our faith before God. Look at Matthew 25. We have here a judgment scene where God is going to be separating the righteous and the unrighteous. And what I want you to see in this is that he's drawing no distinction really between serving God and serving the people of God. Matthew 25, beginning in verse 34, the king will say to those on his right hand, "Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For," now watch what he says here, "I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me." And the righteous will answer him saying, "Lord, did I miss something? When did I see you hungry and feed you? Or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in? Or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you?" Did I miss that somewhere? And the king will answer and say in verse 40, "Assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me." When we serve the people of God, we are serving God. I don't know that she's here. I think Teresa has been worshiping the Spanish Brethren. She's not here. I can go ahead and embarrass her publicly. Teresa has done so much for my mother in the 3 years that we've been here. She has sort of made that, I suppose, her personal project. And everything that she has done for my mother, she has done for me and for Melanie. When we serve the Lord's people, we're serving the Lord. He is so bound up with His people that when we offer service to them, we offer service to Him. Now, it may not be entirely on the same kind of a basis. What Teresa, for example, has done for my mother. What Joel has done for my mother. Joel's done a lot of flower bringing. He probably didn't want me to say that either. Because those are anonymous servers. They don't do what they do for glory or notice. But those kinds of acts of service relieve others, relieve us from doing certain things. But that's really not the way it is with God. When we serve God's people, it doesn't really relieve God of anything. It's no effort for God to do what He needs to do for His people. But what He's beginning to see in all of this is our becoming like Him. He's beginning to see transformation. He's beginning to see godly character growing. And so, serving one another is not an option. It's not an extra. It's not a nice thing to do. And we could probably think of various people in this congregation who seem to go above and beyond the call of duty in serving. But you know, that's our calling, all of us. Not certain select ones in the congregation. But serving is more than merely meeting a requirement. Oh, well, yeah, I've got to do this because this is what the Lord is expecting me to do. It's a freely chosen pattern of life, offered willingly to God out of gratitude for the service rendered to us. God has served us. We return that service to Him with the right heart and the right spirit. Turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. I think Paul says some things interesting here about taking on in himself the person of Christ and striving to be an instrument of Christ in the world as he serves. But look at 2 Corinthians 4, verses 10 and 11. speaking of the apostles as a whole, he says we're always carrying about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus. That the life of Jesus, here's one of those opposites again. We carry about the dying of Jesus, so the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our body. For we who live are always delivered to death for Jesus' sake, that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our mortal flesh. So then death is working in us, but life in you. Carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, that the life of Jesus may be manifest in us. In chapter 5, in verses 19 and 20, he says, God was in Christ reconciling the world to Himself, not imputing their trespasses to them, and has committed to us the word of reconciliation. Therefore, we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God were pleading through us. God is pleading through us. We implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. So what he says, Jesus, the death of Jesus motivates us to let Jesus live in us. So what we do is actually for the Lord's sake. It is the Lord acting through us. And then he talks about God reconciling the world in Jesus. And then he says, and we're ambassadors of the Lord. And so you see this chain. God is in Jesus doing certain things. Jesus is in the apostles doing certain things. And as Jesus lives in us, He's in us accomplishing certain things. And so what he says here, we are ambassadors of Christ as though God were pleading through us. So when we think of this kind of service that the Lord calls on us to render, it's not extracurricular. It's not something other than an essential. It strikes at the essential nature of being a child of God. We're doing, and listen to this, in serving one another, our aim is to do for someone else what God would do if He were present. That is a high calling. I'm being called upon to do for someone else what God would do if He Himself were present. That's how closely we identify with God in our life of faith and why we offer service. Well, what does the service entail? Well, in a word, everything. Everything that is a need. When we submit to one another in serving one another, we're obligating ourselves to fulfill the needs of each other. Specifically in this regard, what we're trying to do is remove any impediment between somebody else and heaven. I think that's the ultimate goal of serving. And we need to look at it, I think, on that higher and spiritual plane. We're striving to help, provide for, remove from. We're striving to do whatever we can to remove an obstacle between someone else and heaven. Now, what's being provided unto that end may be something material. Look at 1 John chapter 3, verses 17 and 18. It may be that in some very definite way, a material lack of what is necessary for life becomes an impediment for a brother or sister. 1 John 3, 17 and 18. Whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and truth. So there's something said here about the nature of service. It's not just to be recognized by us as being important. Certainly, if we're going to provide it, that's a start. But it's not something just orally done, although the service we provide may be oral. It may be a word of encouragement. It may be a word of rebuke. We'll say something about that in a moment. But in essence, this context is providing something material of the necessities of life. And it must not be words only, but actions. But on the other hand, it might be that to help someone and provide a need for them that has a spiritual impact in their life, it might not be giving them something, it might be not doing something. Withholding ourselves from something. An example would be 1 Corinthians chapter 8, beginning in verse 10, where Paul here is talking about not engaging in a liberty. because the need of the brother at that moment was for camaraderie and strength and encouragement. And so Paul says in 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 10, if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things that are offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish. You see the spiritual import of this? Shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died? But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Two things. Number one, look what's at stake here. Their relationship with God. That's what's at stake. The second thing to notice is what he says at the end of verse 12. You know, Jesus in Matthew 25 said, if you do it to one of my brethren, you do it to me. Now it's in the negative. If you hurt one of my children, you hurt me. If you wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ, not just against the brother. So our service to each other might involve giving them something that they need of a material nature. It might involve withholding ourselves from something in order to spiritually buoy someone else who's weak. In Romans chapter 15, what we give to others as servants might be something emotional. Romans chapter 12 and verse 15 simply says, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. It's important for us to feel supported, a part of a group. In our society, we're becoming so individualistic. People end up seeking camaraderie and companionship in the wrong place. But there's such a need to be accepted. There's such a need to belong that they'll often look for that with evil people to satisfy that need. And in the Lord's body, we have an opportunity to belong to something bigger than ourselves, where we're noticed, we're a part of, others care for us. When we are grieving, we're not alone to grieve. They weep with us. But also important is when we rejoice, to have a sense that we share that with someone else. So we rejoice with those that rejoice. We weep with those we weep. With those who weep, it's a togetherness. It is a submitting and a service and a sharing experience with one another that at the end of the day lifts our soul up and convinces us that we're not in this alone. And so what we supply as a servant to one another may be material. It may be emotional. And it may be directly spiritual from the standpoint of being corrective or restorational. Paul provided a great service to the Corinthians, a service from which we still benefit when he writes two epistles to them and figuratively beats them over the head. He's brutal. He is very direct. He's very direct in the book of Colossians. And whoever wrote Hebrews stepped in and provided a service that required a pretty heavy hand at times. And those times are not easy. Those who are attempting to render that service do not do it gleefully. As in, boy, I sure can't wait to get a hold of him. But it takes courage. There's a risk involved. It's a willingness to perhaps put a friendship on the line in order to help someone spiritually, to warn them, to restore them from a place of sin in their life. That's providing an ultimate spiritual service. And so again, what do? When we provide service, we're trying to take away impediments, stumbling blocks, obstacles between people and heaven. It's not a communistic society where we're all just pooling our funds and sharing together so everybody's got the same. Providing service in the family of God is to help other people get to heaven. And to do what we can to make sure that as far as someone else can do it, of course, whether we get to heaven or not ultimately depends on the decisions we make. But we're trying to look out for the needs of each other to make sure that Satan's not gaining an advantage. And so when we submit to one another in serving each other, it's an act of strength, not weakness. It's selflessness, not a lack of ambition. It is given out of our sense of security, not a craving to be noticed or to be befriended by someone, but it arises out of our own relationship with God and the security of that relationship that frees us then to concentrate on someone else. So, back to our original question here. What is greatness in serving? When Jesus talks about those who would be the greatest among you, let him be your servant. What does he mean by that? And what greatness is there? Well, first of all, it's the greatest activity that we can be involved in this life. God himself is the ultimate servant. Yes, he rules, and yes, he has authority, and yes, the Lord will judge us one day, and he physically controls the forces of the universe to hold everything together and promote life. But what God has essentially done in interacting with us is provide service to us. To himself, remove every impediment possible between us and heaven. And God has so often devoted himself through human history to serving mankind, not throwing his weight around, not demonstrating to everybody his great power, but submitting that power to the goodness of man. And we're reminded of that many times in the Scriptures. Now, we'll never be able to serve like God. We'll never be able to perfectly see to the needs of each other. But you know, we may not golf like a pro, but we enjoy doing in some degree what a professional does. We may not cook like Emerald, but we still enjoy preparing meals and eating them. We may not live in a southern living home, but we enjoy appointing our home according to our means and the things that we like. There are a lot of things we do in this life we do imperfectly. And we don't do according to the standard that may be set by someone else. And so the challenge is, do what we can and keep striving for improvement as we seek to serve in this greatest activity. And then it's the greatest achievement. We had a lesson recently, so I'll not belabor the point, but on helping others get to heaven. Folks, what else is there? I mean, really, what else is there? Your income, your job, your position, your notice, your athletic award, your scholarly attainment. I mean, in the end, what difference does it make? But a soul is forever. And as Paul spoke to the Thessalonians about being his joy and his crown, anticipating seeing them in the day of judgment, I'll tell you, that does a lot of things for us. But one thing it'll do is get over the irritation that people might bring to us when we do have to serve them in some capacity. They may be unappreciative. It may be they got themselves into the mess. It may be they don't particularly like me anyway. Serving other people is not always a pat on the back and a nice, warm, glowing feeling. But where's the focus? Is the focus on helping a soul get to heaven and seeing them in eternal glory and realizing within the proper confines of the sentiment, I had something to do with that. God and I had something to do with that. That's not pride. That's the purpose that we're here for. That's why God has given us all the tools and restored to us the relationship so we can then turn and help others be restored to Him. It's the greatest activity, it's the greatest achievement, and it has the greatest reward. Turn with me back to Hebrews chapter 6, the last verse that we'll look at, the lesson this morning. Hebrews 6. Jesus himself not only becomes the example of service, we'll probably be covering that in future lessons as well, but he becomes the example of the reward of service. Jesus says in that passage back in Matthew 20, we didn't really stress that, I came to serve, not be served. That's how the life of Jesus is summarized by himself. I did not come to be served, but to serve and give myself a ransom for many. And when Jesus was willing to do that, lose himself in service, even lose his life in service, God exalted him. God raised him up. God gave him a kingdom. God makes his enemies bow at his feet. God glorified him. In Hebrews 6 and verse 10, the writer says, God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love, which you have shown toward His name, in that you have ministered, served. You've ministered to the saints and do minister. I ask you if you knew any of the ball boys' names at any tennis match. Obviously, you didn't. And most of the time when the tennis match is over, the winner is on center court. He's got a trophy. He's got a plate. He's got some kind of a cup. And he's walking around the court, and everybody's taking pictures of him, and they're clapping and they're cheering, and oh, he's just basking in the glory of it all. And I don't know where the ball boys and the ball girls go, but they're nowhere to be seen. Unless you're watching Wimbledon. And at the end of the tennis match at Wimbledon, all the ball boys and all the ball girls are lined up on the court, center court, and the Duke and Duchess of Kent, the royalty who preside over Wimbledon, walk out and they're shaking hands and speaking to all of these young boys and girls. They're given a little recognition at Wimbledon. Can you imagine having done your job and then having the Duke or the Duchess come by and acknowledge you? What a great thing that would be for a young teenager. Well, God's going to acknowledge us for our service. God is not unjust to forget our ministering, Hebrews 6:10. It's the greatest reward. It may not come in this life. It probably won't come in this life. But it'll come. God has set Himself to see to that there will be reward for the service that we render in this life. What does Jesus say? Do what you do in the closet, and God will reward you openly. There's motive and there's purpose. There's reward. There's example. There's precedent in the Lord Himself for us to be serving each other. And that's the theme of the year. You'll be hearing a lot about that in coming sermons, I'm sure. But as we draw the service to a close, we now, as it were, take on the role of being a servant. This song is designed to encourage you and invite you to come and make whatever is wrong in your life before God right. And we're your servants in this. We're going to be singing to encourage you and help you. We're willing to pray with you and for you. We're willing to counsel with you and study with you, do whatever we can do to take away the obstacle that's between you and heaven. Whatever that obstacle is, you have to answer that and you have to identify it. But if we can help you remove it, we'll be glad to do it while we're standing and singing.